From Michigan Public, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, another candidate for governor sits down pre-primary to talk to us about why he's running. It's Genesee County Sheriff Chris Swanson.
I think the state has a great position to help local communities, but not as an adversarial relationship, as an ally relationship, and that's what you're going to get with me.
Then we break down a new report detailing decades of sexual misconduct at Interlochen Center for the Arts.
They announced publicly that the investigation was happening, and they called upon alumni to contact directly.
Plus, on It's Just Politics, President Donald Trump visits Michigan and Governor Gretchen Whitmer weighs in on the state's Senate race with a slate of endorsements.
I think it underscores what this is about, which is the establishment versus the outsiders.
All that coming up today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. On today's show, what President Trump's latest visit to Michigan can tell us about our place in this national electoral moment.
Well, according to polling that came out this week, it is all tied up.
That's coming up in the second half of this hour. But first, Michigan is, of course, electing a new governor this fall. And in the primary, voters will choose nominees who will appear on the November election ballot. As part of Michigan Public's election 2026 coverage, we're interviewing the candidates for governor from both major parties. Chris Swanson currently serves as Genesee County's sheriff. He's also a Democratic candidate for governor. Swanson spoke with Morning Edition host Doug Tribou.
What will your top three priorities be if you're elected governor?
Three tenets: protect, serve, and unify. Now, specifically, we're doing an audit at Huron Valley. We're making sure that we have an Epstein file open to give any victims in Michigan a voice. And we're doing a moratorium on all DT and consumer rate hikes for the state of Michigan for 6 months till we figure it all out.
You have been critical of the approach taken by U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, during the second Trump administration. As governor, how would your administration respond to the mass deportation efforts being carried out by the Trump administration?
Well, I'm critical after 34 years of being in law enforcement and serving as the sheriff, because that's not how we do business. So as governor, no masks in Michigan law enforcement. I can't control what the feds do, but I can tell you in Michigan, you're going to know you're dealing with law enforcement. We identify ourselves for a reason. Our public trust is hard to build and easy to lose. The whole ICE model is dysfunctional and it can't exist or sustain.
One of the most hotly contested topics in Michigan and across the U.S. right now is the construction of large-scale data centers. If elected governor, how would you approach data center projects and potential legislation about them?
I am a union-endorsed candidate. They want to build projects in labor, but they don't want to build projects that are going to harm the environment, drain the energy grid, or have protests from local communities. So we do things right. We listen to the people. We divide the state in three colors: yellow, red, and green. Yellow means there's infrastructure and there's a desire for any kind of technology or manufacturing. There's a red zone, which is no infrastructure and no desire for any kind of development. Just leave those communities alone. Green, of course, is infrastructure below and above grade. Data centers have not had that. And that's why we have so much upheaval. And we've got to settle it. Guardrails, and there's got to be truth and transparency. What are we paying for? What are we getting? And what do we need?
One of the common themes that I have seen in our newscasts, in our reporting and interviews over my years here at Michigan Public is the push-pull between state and local authority. How do you see that factoring in to the data center projects? You're talking about grading communities on color. Who's setting those grades? And when we're respecting local control, does the state not weigh in with some overarching regulation in your view of it?
I talked to the Michigan Municipal Leagues, and you have got city managers and mayors and township supervisors that are fighting for funds that their taxpayers give to the state, but that revenue sharing is not coming back. They don't want somebody to come into their community who's never been there. I think the state has a great position to help local communities, but not as an adversarial relationship, as an ally relationship. And that's what you're going to get with me. I work with people and we get it done. We may not always see eye to eye, but we're going to be able to work together and not just, again, jam it down the throats of locals.
We have seen a lot of debate over what the state should or should not do to help attract and keep businesses in Michigan. One major point of contention is the Michigan Economic Development Corporation and its taxpayer-funded spending on private businesses. In your view, what does Michigan need to do to develop and maintain high-quality, high-paying jobs?
There is a distrust in how MEDC delivers funds. There are great projects, but when you see the controversy that's there now, how did that happen? How is it the lawmakers sign NDAs so they don't talk about it? At the MEDC level, you get the money and then you do the work. That's why we're doing a complete audit at MEDC. That's your money and my money. And if it's going to waste, if people are just getting gifted with no accountability, then we're not doing what that fund and that idea is meant to do, and that is to grow the economy. The state can be a partner. Right now, in any business, I'm a business owner. We're registered at the Small Business Association of Michigan. When I see a 517 number come in, I ask myself, what did I do wrong, and how much more do they want out of my tax?
Just to be clear for our listeners, when you're talking about the 517 area code, you're talking about calls coming from the Lansing area?
That's correct.
Yes, and so what's your business?
My wife is a CEO. They buy Amazon and Target liquidated truckloads, and they break them down into different categories. And then from there, we sell them to e-commerce and those that are working in stores. We call them bin stores. I used to have assisted living home. We had that for 2 years. I had an entertainment business and inflatables. We had that for 10 years, sold it, bought it back. Man, it's tough doing business in Michigan, and it's tough being a business owner. It shouldn't be.
Two leaders of the Michigan State Police, specifically the director, Colonel James Grady, and Lieutenant Colonel Amy Brimacombe, were sharply criticized in a Michigan House Oversight Committee report released earlier this year. The report said they'd created a toxic environment within the state police. They also received a no confidence vote from two professional organizations last year. Governor Whitmer has stood by Grady, whom she appointed. Would you keep the current leadership in place at MSP?
I am not in those conversations, but I hear from the group that are the state police the same thing that you just reported. But no disrespect, because I'm not in those conversations, I said. But I agree. I hear it on the street. There is a breakdown between the street level and the administration. I'm not there to fix it yet, but it will be fixed.
Governor Whitmer is term limited after 8 years in office. You're both prominent Democrats here in Michigan with a lot of common ground on ideology and policy. Where do you differ with the governor on policy?
Our background. I mean, I'm friends with the governor, and we worked well together over the last two terms. But my path is completely different than anybody running on either side, coming from a huge county that has gone through tremendous challenge. We've come up with ideas and things that have gone statewide and nationwide. GHOST has started in May of 2018. It's called Genesee Human Oppression Strike Team. And we are proactive in finding predators and people that are sex offenders coming to have sex with underage kids and vulnerable adults. But also my education experience. I've been on faculty at the University of Michigan for 28 years. I've been a teacher in public education. And then in fact, that we just talked about the business owners, these are things that are different.
Well, I certainly understand that you and Governor Whitmer are different people and have come to your offices through different paths. But how specifically would you differ from the governor on policy or the types of decisions you would make if you're elected?
Yeah, and I go back to our backgrounds, and there's things that I have done and that it is an easy transition into the governor's house, but it's the energy, the enthusiasm, the inspiration that I bring that's different than anybody. And, you know, I can't say that, you know, what she's doing or what I do, and it would be completely different. I can tell you that on 1/1/27, a completely different philosophy and ideology is coming in. And that's what I can tell you is going to be different.
That was Genesee County's Sheriff Chris Swanson speaking with Michigan Public's Doug Tribue. Swanson is a Democratic candidate for governor. The Michigan primary election is on August 4th. If you're looking for conversations with other candidates, head to our website, michiganpublic.org. For many people living through homelessness, finding a place to talk about their experiences and what they need is difficult. But now there's a space just for that. Traverse City's Resilience Program participant meetings began earlier this year. It's developed a rare way for peers to offer support to each other Interlochen Public Radio's Maxwell Howard explains.
You're good. Thank you so much.
A small group is gathered on chairs in the basement of downtown Traverse City's Grace Episcopal Church. Stephanie Elaine is one of the co-chairs, but also a peer to those attending.
I was staying at Safe Harbor, and yeah, I was struggling, obviously. Most people staying at Safe Harbor aren't there by choice.
Elaine was recently homeless, and the shelter Safe Harbor helped her get on her feet. It's an experience that makes people here in the group trust her especially. It's something she and another organizer, Hannah Westcott, joke about.
As much as I love you, Hannah, living at Safe Harbor is a lot different. Yeah. Mm-hmm. They know you're trustworthy, too. I've never heard them say a bad word about you.
Sandwiches are passed around, and then the meeting opens with a few announcements. Supposedly, there's a card being passed around town saying that if you get caught with drug paraphernalia, you can tell police you're throwing it away and get off scot-free. Westcott and Elaine say that's not true.
It's bullhunky.
Yeah, it is. It's straight baloney.
After that, it's a lot of listening. Participants come with questions, troubleshoot each other's problems. Thomas McDonald lives in a campground in Interlochen. He wants to talk about the new proposal to consolidate homelessness services away from downtown.
There's no bus stop that goes directly there.
Yeah,
it's absolutely true.
Because if there's no stop there, everybody has to walk or bike. Or pay for an Uber.
Westcott explains that the local bus authority has been a part of the conversation, even if no routes are planned yet. Okay. Next, the group talks about the city's new affordable housing, which they don't think is affordable, really. They catch each other up on how other people on the street are doing. Notes are taken to relay up to service providers. And that ends the meeting. But perhaps the most powerful thing, though, is the presence of peers helping one another.
These are my people. I love them.
Just a little earlier, Elaine brought food to some people in a nearby park. And the fact that they knew who she was and what she'd been through, it had an effect. One man even told her so.
I was talking today and he's like, you know what, maybe I could quit drinking. He's like, if you can quit drinking, he's like, you know, you're like a testament to us. And I was like, oh, thank you.
That's beautiful.
The Resilience Group participant meeting meets every third Monday at Grace Episcopal Church. The next meeting is August 17th and is open to anyone experiencing homelessness, substance abuse, and mental health issues. I'm Maxwell Howard.
It's time for us to take a short break now. After that, we'll dig into a new report on decades of sexual misconduct at Interlochen Center for the Arts.
Interlochen says at that time, they decided that they would hire an outside law firm to look into what else might be out there.
We'll be right back. You're with Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Interlochen Center for the Arts, an internationally respected academy in northern Michigan that's been educating students and providing summer experiences for generations of creative people, is reckoning with crimes committed on its campus against children for decades. A new report commissioned by Interlochen details dozens of cases of sexual abuse dating back to the mid-20th century. Ed Ronco is news director at Interlochen Public Radio, and he's reviewed and written about the report. Ed, hello.
Hello.
Can you tell us a little bit about why Interlochen commissioned this report?
It was a couple years ago that a former student who was attending the Interlochen Arts Academy, which is the boarding high school, back in the 1970s, came forward 2 years ago and said that she had been sexually abused by Byron Hansen, who is a beloved member of the music faculty, worked for Interlochen for 50 years, has sort of within the institution, I think you could say legendary status. In fact, one of Interlochen's own annual reports a few years ago when he died in 2021 called him a legend. So it was a shocking thing to hear for the institution. And Interlochen says at that time, they decided that they would hire an outside law firm to look into what else might be out there, what other problems might exist with this faculty member or the 60s or 70s at the boarding school. As things came forward from other alumni, the scope of the investigation quickly expanded to all of Interlochen's programs throughout all of its history.
Yeah. Do we know how the report was made? I understand that a law firm compiled this, but was it all self-reporting? Was there some investigation of things that were said?
Interlochen reached out through the law firm to various alumni. When they commissioned this investigation, when they asked this law firm near Boston that has apparently experience with civil rights investigations, sexual abuse investigations, when they asked them to do that, they announced publicly that the investigation was happening, and they called upon alumni to contact directly this law firm. Right there on the Interlochen website, they put the name of the lawyer, the phone number, the email address, and counted on alumni to go and talk to them. We also know that the law firm, as they heard stories, reached out to connected people, other alumni who could corroborate the reports, family members in some cases of alumni, people who used to work here, and those accused, some of the 47 adults who were faculty, staff, or had other connections to Interlochen. They were also contacted by the law firm to see if they wanted to respond. Most of them did not. A few did.
Can you give us the general sense of how many students came forward and said, this abuse happened to me?
There were 180 interviews conducted. About 150 individuals spoke. That resulted in 70 separate instances of sexual misconduct from the 1950s through the 2010s.
And I wonder if there's something of an arc that we could describe. Are we talking about 60 cases that happened in the 1970s and then 10 last year? Or if we were to make a bell curve, you know, does it appear there was a period when abuse was really rampant?
As you look at the report, it's pretty centered on the 60s, 70s, and 80s. The 90s, too, most of it is before the year 2000. There are some things in the 2000s and 2010s.
Yeah. Does the report name the abusers?
It names some of them. It names four people. Byron Hansen is one of them. Again, that former faculty member. Jack Hood, another former faculty member, is among them. Charlie McWhirter, he was a trustee from 1970 to 1999. All three of those men are deceased. There's a fourth name, Thomas Clower, and I might be pronouncing that incorrectly, but he was on the arts faculty from 2003 to 2005, and his name is included because he was convicted of criminal sexual conduct, and that is already part of the public record. Interlochen fired him. This was back in 2005. I should say, the report itself lists everybody as, if you're a reporting alumni, it's alum one or alum two. If you're one of the accused, it's respondent one, respondent two. Interlochen then went forward with a cover letter that it attached to the front of the report that identifies those four people. So the investigators themselves did not identify anybody by name, but Interlochen did say, look, these four people are folks we're going to identify.
Yeah. The ones who were not named, was that intentionally done with the presumption that there may be legal action?
That's right. So Interlochen forwarded all the names to the Grand Traverse County prosecutor. They're sharing that with the Grand Traverse County sheriff as well. In their cover letter, Interlochen's rationale for not wanting to share the rest of the names is exactly that, April, that they don't want to interfere with any possible legal action that might come from this, either criminal or civil.
Ed, there are obviously some cases that have been much more recent and that we've heard a lot more about through the uncovering of Jeffrey Epstein's legal troubles and the case against him and what survivors have come forward and said. It might be easy for some people to look at this report and say, well, survivors have grown up, survivors have moved on, and that abusers, you know, in some cases having died may be beyond the reach of the law. I'm just kind of curious about how this report might contribute to reckoning. Have you maybe heard from any survivors about what they want to happen?
Yeah, I have not heard directly from any survivors, but the report certainly has. And there's a whole section of it that talks about what the survivors want. I have been having conversations with experts in sexual abuse and advocacy for survivors of sexual abuse who all will tell you nothing is in the past, really. It's a trauma that lingers. And so there is a need to address it for those who survived, but also to make sure it doesn't happen again. So the survivors who spoke to the investigators said that they want Interlochen to take this information and improve, have better systems to protect students, have clearer ways to report misconduct and abuse, for people who work here to be able to report, and for students certainly to feel empowered to report. The big problem we often hear about when it comes to reporting what's going on is that there are barriers to doing so. And many of the folks who spoke to investigators say it's important that Interlochen continue to remove those barriers. And Interlochen would tell you that they have work to do, but that they've also done a lot of work. In the last 25 years or so, they have made a point to say there are mechanisms in place for faculty and staff to report problems. There are mechanisms in place for students to anonymously report abuse, even one that allows them to sidestep the school entirely called OK to Say, which is a statewide program, a tip line for school safety issues, whether that's, you know, school violence or sex crimes at a boarding school. So they will point to lots of advances in the ability to report and the ability to ensure a safer future. But I think they would also acknowledge that looking at this past is important to making sure that no stone is left unturned when it comes to figuring out what can be done to keep students safe.
It's one thing to talk about having paths to report, but what is Interlochen saying about the culture that it has today and whether anything is any different than it was in the 80s?
Interlochen is saying that the culture on campus is a world apart from the 1980s. I can tell you that Interlochen staff are all trained that they are mandatory reporters, which means you have an obligation to report if something seems amiss with a student or if a student tells you that there has been abuse. And it's not just a workplace policy. There are legal consequences if you don't. So they drill that into employees. They would tell you, I think, that, yes, it's a different culture. And I think one of the great difficulties in going through this report is seeing those things, April, where staff members were told in the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s sometimes that something was going on and either turned the other way or in a couple cases outlined in the report shamed the survivor. You know, very shameful things in here that are outlined by the survivors. And I think Interlochen and the conversations we've had with the president, Trey Devi, and just by virtue of being on campus, I think Interlochen's taking that to heart today.
Ed Ronco is the news director at Interlochen Public Radio. If you'd like to read some recent coverage, as well as find links to the report that we've been discussing, you can go to iprnews.org. Ed, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. As PGA golfers take the course tomorrow for the final edition of the Rocket Classic at the Detroit Golf Club, we wanted to share a story from retiree Tom Chulig. When he was a teenager in the summer of 1970, he worked at Detroit's Rackham Golf Course, which was known for being a diverse place to play. On one ordinary workday, he got sprinkled with some Motown magic that stayed with him his entire life.
So I got involved with Parks and Recreation, City of Detroit. And they offered me a position for that summer, 1970, as a ranger at the golf course. And I said, wow, sounds like fun. The best way I can describe a ranger is that you walked around the golf course and you wanted to make sure everybody, the golfers, were happy, that there weren't any problems. Lem Barney and Mel Farr were two of the characters that would show up, and if you're not familiar with them, they were on the Lions football team. They were quite regular. And then you had Marvin Gaye and Berry Gordy would show up a lot. They were regulars also. One of my favorite people there was Ben Davis, who was the pro. I knew Ben Davis had been the pro at Rackham since the early 50s, and it was pretty unusual. I think it was unique to have a black pro at any golf course. And I know that the bylaws for the Rackham golf course stated that there could be no prejudice. You had any race, creed, color, you come play golf. That's what the golf course was for. Everybody seemed to be comfortable there. Everybody that worked there was very laid back, and I'd heard rumors that in some golf courses there was still tension going on, where this group here, everybody just came and enjoyed themselves. It was a beautiful way to have a day out golfing and no stress. So Marvin was quite the regular there, and he was it's hard to describe. I describe it as Marvin was as mellow as his music. He was just very laid back, easygoing, easy to talk with, easy to tease. And generally when he came, he would drive his Rolls Royce and park it into our employee parking lot. One day he came in with his Excalibur that was known in the Detroit area. I think that it had also been used as a prize on some of the radio shows. You could win his car for a night. It's called an Excalibur, and the Excalibur was a car that tried to copy a Mercedes-Benz SSK, which was from 1928, so very old style. Long hood, exhaust coming out either side of the hood. There's no doors on the vehicle. You just stepped over the side, sat down in it, and stuck your arm out on a padded leather ledge. The drivetrain of this vehicle was the Corvette drivetrain, so it had a 300 horsepower, 350 engine in it, and it could do 0 to 60 in 6 seconds. So it was, for me, a very unique car. What occurred then after that was he was coming through the clubhouse, and I teased him about it. I don't remember the exact words, but I teased him, and he stopped and he looked at me and he reached into his pocket, pulled out his keys, and he said, "Here, take it for a ride." And I looked at him, and I tried to be polite as far as no, but this is a 19-year-old Detroit boy, and you're offering him the ride of a lifetime. And before I knew it, okay, and off I went. So we get her up, boom, boom, you know, and I said, "Well, I'll just go into the neighborhood." It was Huntington Woods. I went into the neighborhood a little bit, and he had a button on the dash. It was the horn, and I pushed that, and it gave this da-da, da-da-da-da-da. I'd never heard anything like that before. Oh, my goodness, you know. And so I'm tooling around, and I'm thinking, where can I go next? So let's go to my parents' house, you know, and we'll show them the car, you know. So I get to my parents' house, and my dad's not there. My dad was the picture taker of the house. My mom never mastered photography. So I'm in the car, and she's going to take a picture, and she did. She only took one, because back then you only took one picture. And later on, as I saw it after it had been developed, and it was like from the front looking back at the car, she caught exactly half the car, like from the center of the radiator and the right side. Luckily, I'm in it, the picture. She got half the car. So there, okay, where do I go to next? Well, we can cruise Woodward with this, can't we? Yes. What was the thing to do back in 1970 in the 60s? Cruise Woodward. So I was out there tooling up Woodward, then down Woodward. So this is a drivetrain of a Corvette, and when you tipped it, it was an automatic, and when you stepped into it, I didn't floor it. I didn't have that amount of courage on Woodward, but the acceleration was right there, you know, with the Corvette. People were looking at me and pointing at me, and, you know, I'd stop at a light. People would ask me, "Is that Marvin Gaye's car?" You know, "Oh, yeah, yeah, that's, yep, he gave it to me. I'm just testing it out," you know, and it got to the point where it was almost embarrassing, but it was fun, embarrassing. I'd never driven anything so powerful. Well, eventually I started becoming aware of the time. You know, how long have I been out here? Is Marvin playing 9 holes or is he playing 18 holes? Maybe I should get back. So I tool into Rackham, and I walk in, and it's getting a little on the dusk side now, and I pretty quiet in the clubhouse, and there's Marvin sitting at a table in the clubhouse with some of my coworkers. And my coworkers look at me, and I think daggers were the best thing you could say when they looked at me. They didn't say anything, but, uh-oh. So I came up right away to Mr. Gay. I'm sorry, you know, I apologize. Oh, no problem. Don't worry about it. You know, and I picked up his bags. I walked with him out to his car, and I thanked him profusely. And I remember standing there watching him drive off, just could not believe what had just occurred, because this was a Detroit boy dream. I had just experienced a wonderful couple hours. When I got back to the table, the guys explained to me, well, he had only golfed 9 holes. So he'd been sitting there over an hour waiting for me to return his car. I expected something from him, and he asked me, did you enjoy yourself? Did you enjoy the ride? And what could I say? I'm sure my eyes were large and just had never driven anything like that before. So I come into work the next day, and I get the come into my office from the manager, close the door. You know, and then I was read the riot act as far as what had occurred the previous day. He docked my pay for the time I was out in the car. And then he sent me on my way out to Ranger, and I'm sure there was an extra zest in my step as I walked out there onto the golf course. As a 19-year-old, 1970 was a good year.
That's all for Stateside for today. I'm April Baer. We'll see you tomorrow.